this is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, having few duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud and demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove, wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be happy, whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be happy. Let none deceive another, or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another, even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child. So with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, free from hatred and ill will, whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness. One should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding, by not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world.
Okay. So, there you are. That is the Metta Sutta. And now I will, as usual, just do a little bit of introduction to meditation. And as usual, when you start out meditating, you know what it's like. You just need to learn to relax and to be at ease and really just to get into a good mood, yeah, and enjoy what you're doing. Yeah. And I've always found that one of the biggest problems with meditation practice is that people go to the meditation object too quickly. Yeah. They go to the breath, they're not really ready for the breath because the mindfulness is not there. And then they ask questions. What am I doing wrong? I can't really meditate on the breath. What's wrong? Well, what is wrong is that you're not ready. The mind doesn't have the mindfulness to enable you to stay with the breath. So one of the critical factors with meditation is always the idea of establishing mindfulness first, waiting for the mind to calm down, waiting for the disturbances of ordinary life to die down. Yeah, and this is what happens if you just wait peacefully in the present moment. Things tend to die down, and then gradually you move towards a more clear state. But what do you find is that even though you do this, even though you sit back and you kind of allow things to calm down, very often it's not enough. It doesn't really need the clarity always. Sometimes it may do, sometimes it does not. It's a bit unreliable, essentially, just kind of sitting back and waiting. Yeah. So there's two things that we can do. One of them is to remind ourselves to let go of the things of the world. Yeah, and this, I think, is a very important part of meditation practice, to let go of things of the world and to remind yourself of the unreliability of worldly things. And when you remember the unreliability, which is just one way of thinking about the problems and the suffering of the world, you lose interest in the world. And when you lose interest in the world, it's much easier to stay with a meditation object. But sometimes that's not enough, because sometimes when you focus too much on the negative in the world, sometimes you can feel maybe a bit sad or depressed or a bit kind of despairing. Why is the world so difficult? And you kind of feel this kind of sense of what a terrible thing it is to be alive and all these kind of things. So you have to balance that out. And you can't really just focus on the negative, because it leads to an imbalance in the mind. So a very important point is then to actually bring the mind to something uplifting, something which kind of gives you that extra boost in the mind, with a bit of joy perhaps, or a bit of lightness in the mind, and all of these kind of things. And this is a very important balancing game. On the one hand, saying, enough of the world for now, at least during this meditation, rejecting the world for a while, not being interested in the world, that's one side of the balance. And the other side is to build up the positive qualities, build up that sense of joy and happiness, and yay, wow, this is wonderful. Yeah, I'm doing something marvelous in my life. I've got all these great spiritual companions from everywhere around the world. Yeah, from Japan, from the United States, from Latvia, from the UK, and wherever else. Isn't that what a wonderful thing it is to have all of these marvelous spiritual companions? And one of the tricks here, one of the ways of doing that, is what I would call like the zooming out effect. Very often we are too close to our problem, we're too close to our daily things, and the little things in our day-to-day life obstruct our ability to be positive, they obstruct our ability to be calm, because they happened to us very recently, day-to-day life, and because it is close to us, these are the things that we remember. So sometimes you need to take a step back, you need to zoom out a little bit, and you need to look at your life in a kind of broader context. You see your life, okay, I was born over here, I'm dying over there, and what am I doing in the middle? I'm doing good things. Wow, I'm heading in the right direction. I'm on an upward path. Everything is sloping upwards. Wow, how come I'm so fortunate? How come this is happening to me? Well, it's because I got this really amazing teachings of the Buddha, this Dhamma, which is, the, as far as I'm concerned, is the supreme spiritual teaching in the world. There's nothing like the Dhamma anywhere. You can't find any kind of spiritual teachings like this in the same way as the Buddha. These are so profound and so direct and so immediate, speaking directly to your heart. The more you get into the Dhamma, the more uplifted you are, just by thinking that you are a disciple of these teachings. You have them, we still have them. These are the teachings of the Buddha, been passed down for 2,500 years. I am a disciple of the Buddha. Wow, I'm a disciple of the Buddha. And when I read the sutta, the Buddha is talking to me. That's pretty awesome, That's pretty kind of the greatest spiritual genius in human history is our teacher. And that's kind of mind-blowing when you get into that idea. So you have the Buddha as your teacher. You have these amazing Dhamma teachings to support you and to kind of guide you in the right directions. And then you have the Sangha. The Sangha here, usually the Sangha means the monastic community. But you can think of the Sangha as all the Kalyanamittas you have, all the spiritual friends you have, people in the Armadale group, people from overseas, all the people who are members of the Buddha Society, and all of these people are helping us, lifting us up, guiding us in the right way. Because we practice together, there's a kind of force in this, a kind of power to this. We have teachers like Ajahn Brahm, who's been a monk for, 46 years or something like that. And he's one of these amazing spiritual teachers. I've lived with him for 25 years. And Ajahn Brahm is pretty awesome in many ways. And what a wonderful thing it is to have all of this support around us. And how incredibly fortunate we are to be part of this kind of spiritual community. So the idea here is to zoom out a little bit, to look at your life from a big picture, the bird's eye view, instead of the kind of the close-up view. And when you see that, you can zoom out from all the everyday problems and you can see the general trajectory of your life. And the general trajectory is moving in the right direction. You're moving upwards. Yeah, you're on this kind of path. It's a bit bumpy, that path, because life is bumpy. Yeah, but it's heading in the right way here. You're moving towards something here. You don't know what that something is. You don't know where the end of the path is, but you know it's pretty nice, yeah? It's heading in the right direction. Things are getting better. You're experiencing things that maybe you never experienced before in terms of peace, in terms of joy, in terms of a reduction in problems in life. So this is one way of thinking about what is happening, one way of lifting you up, seeing the positive in life, because this has to, is such an important part to counterbalance the tendency always to see the negative in our life because it is so close to us. Bring back that sense of, you know, things actually being, from a big perspective, things are pretty good. And then you can, maybe you can overcome some of those little problems and establish some of those positive perceptions in your mind instead. Do this regularly. Learn how to think about the Dhamma, think about the Buddha, because it really is when we learn how to think about these things in the right way that they become so powerful. Yeah, it becomes so extraordinarily great. It's this ability to, you know, Buddha may seem like a very distant teacher from India 2,500 years ago, but if you think about the Buddha in the right way, you realize the Buddha, he was a teacher of humanity. Yeah, even gods, they say in the suttas, you know, even animals, if they can listen properly and become humans, perhaps. So the Buddha is a teacher of everyone. And one of the interesting things about the Buddha, one of the things that he says very early on when he starts teaching him, is that he says he is rolling forth the wheel of the Dhamma Chakra. He's rolling that forth in the world. And because the Buddha has the realization that these teachings are so powerful that they will roll out in the world. They will move from one civilization to another, one culture to another, one country to another, from one time to another time. Yeah, these are things that will keep on rolling out in the world. And because the Buddha realized that, he taught specifically a teaching that is universally valid, that everyone really can relate to. And that is why even 2,500 years later, you can relate to these teachings. These are not teachings that are, you know, narrow and small and kind of belong to a certain era that was given to a certain tribe. Most religions are like that. They were started out in a certain tribe somewhere. Christianity is really like that. It started out in the Middle East to the, you know, Jewish people or whatever. And it was really their God that is the kind of foundation of Christianity. But Buddhism has always been this universal religion from the very beginning. Yeah, it has a very different kind of outlook. It's this big universal outlook. And that is why it speaks to our heart in such a powerful way, even 2,500 years later. So when the Buddha did speak 2,500 years ago, he actually thought about people, yeah, people in the present day, people at any time, really. So in a very real sense, the Buddha is your teacher. Yeah, sometimes mediated through other teachers, but behind all of that is the Buddha, and that is the power that we are drawing on. Pretty good, isn't it? So try to think like that. If you think like that, it's going to give you a energy boost and move you forward and give you something extra oomph in your meditation practice. Okay, let's get down to business. Business means meditation. So make sure you sit comfortably. Yeah, we're going to do the usual procedures for meditation. So make sure you are comfortable. And close your eyes. I recommend closing the eyes for meditation purposes. And just start out as normal, just by feeling your body and feeling your mind for a while. And as you feel the body, feel the mind, and see if there is any tensions there, any problems or any pains or whatever. And just move yourself about around a little bit if you have to. And if you feel a tension in the shoulders or in the stomach or whatever, take a few deep breaths. Allow everything to expand nicely and then exhale. And do that a few times until you really relax, you are really at ease. So much of the tension of the body comes from the mind, because the mind controls the body. So if you are able to focus on the body and just relax the body, the mind also comes along with it. So start out by just relaxing, sitting back, and just enjoying what we're doing here. And please take a lot of time at the beginning of the meditation. It is now that you create the foundation on which the rest of the meditation will be built. So make sure the foundation is solid. And a solid foundation is a foundation of just being at ease, of just letting go, of allowing things to be. The most important quality at the beginning here is just the quality of being patient, being supremely patient, allowing things to calm down, allowing the world to recede from your mind, just like the ocean receding in the distance when the tide becomes low. In the same way, you allow the world to recede and you come into the present moment instead. But it takes time. Allow it that time. Give it that time. And if you find it is hard to let go of the world, then encourage yourself by a few wise thoughts. And one way of thinking about the spiritual path is that this is what really matters in life. This is what is truly meaningful. This is what will give real results in the long run. Everything else you do in life is really just a support for what you are doing now. It is there to help you in the spiritual practice. And once you get that priority right, that this is what is meaningful, this is what matters, and everything else is secondary, it is to support what you're doing now, then you can let go of those secondary matters. They have no real meaning now. Now you're doing what actually is important. And just enjoy what you are doing. Never forget that meditation is supposed to be an enjoyable and positive experience. If it isn't enjoyable, you have to ask yourself why that is the case. Maybe you need just to relax a little bit more. Maybe you need a slightly change in attitude or whatever. But always look for the comfort, the ease of the body. The only way to deepen your meditation is through the ease and the happiness and joy that comes in meditation practice. The Buddha always talks about ease and happiness when it comes to meditation. And as you calm down and you become hopefully a bit more mindful, if you need a bit of a boost in your meditation, try some very simple and gentle reflections. Just turning your mind towards something positive and beautiful. Remind yourself, for instance, that you are a disciple of the greatest spiritual genius in human history. What an amazing thing that is, to be a direct disciple of one of the most amazing personalities to have walked on this planet. And here we are in the present day, I too, each one of us is a disciple of that person. What a marvelous thing that is. What a tremendous potential that has in terms of spiritual progress and spiritual benefits. So rejoice in that. And take that to heart in a deep way, and it will brighten you up and make sure that your future is bright too. And when you are ready, when the mind is reasonably stable and present, very gently move to the breath and just hang out with the breath and regard the breath as the best friend in the world, someone who is always there, always sustaining you, always in an unobtrusive and nice way. What a marvelous friend this breath is. And as you focus on the breath in a positive way, gradually allow the meditation to become more and more peaceful. Okay, so now we're coming close to the end of the meditation. And before we come to the end, just take a few moments just to reflect on the meditation today. And if you feel a bit more at ease, a bit more peaceful, a bit more positive in whatever way, ask yourself why that is the case. And that why will give you an answer to how meditation actually is supposed to work. Okay, everyone, so that's the meditation for now. And does anyone have any question or anything they would want to ask about that? Any comments or anything at all? Please feel free to say whatever you like.
But you can put it in a chat box if you don't want to speak. I've got the chat box open.
If I may, this is Martha. I would like to ask you to talk a little bit more about how the life outside meditation supports meditation as opposed to vice versa, because I've been thinking about it the exact opposite way, and because I just got called into work 5 hours early where there's a significant amount of incorrect speech in the way of gossip and backstabbing and whatnot.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, sure, of course. No, I think that's a very good question. It's a very important point, actually, because if we get this wrong, then it becomes very much a hindrance in our meditation practice. And I will give you an example. If you know, it's very common in the world to meditate to support your ordinary life. And I can understand why people do that. And I think in some ways it is fair enough. But the problem is that if you meditate to support your ordinary life, you are making your ordinary life more important than the meditation. Yeah, the meditation is just a support, and your ordinary life is what really matters. And the problem with that is that as soon as you sit down and you start to become peaceful, you will start to think about those things that matter to you, that those things that are important. And if you make your ordinary life more important than the meditation, it means you're going to start thinking about the problems you have. You're going to start thinking about the bad speech at work or whatever it is, yeah? Because this is what actually your life really consists of at the end of the day. Yeah? So this is the problem. It actually encourages us to lose our track in meditation and to kind of go back to our worldly existence. So instead, if you put things the other way around and you put your spiritual life on top, and your worldly life, you see it as a support for your spiritual life, then there is no need to think about your ordinary life when you meditate, because now you have come to what really matters. The ordinary life is actually secondary, so why should you think about those things that support what you're doing now when they are just a support, and this is what is actually meaningful to you? So by turning things around, you can stop yourself from being so affected by the world around you, and for your mind going back to those things. Now you're doing what really matters. And it is important to understand this in the right way. It doesn't mean that we don't care about our ordinary life. It doesn't mean that we don't, you know, look after our family, look after our spiritual companions, and that we even look after our work colleagues or whatever it is. It doesn't mean that at all. In fact, it means the exact opposite. Because if your ordinary life is going to support your spiritual life, you have to live your ordinary existence in a good way. Yeah, you have to be kind to people. You have to care. You have to have compassion. You have to be a kind of a beacon for other ones in the world. Because unless you live your ordinary life in a spiritual way, it is not going to help your meditation practice. It is not going to actually be a support. When you sit down and meditate, it's not going to work any longer. So in a sense, what we're doing here is that we are integrating everything that we do, absolutely everything, every thought you have, if you like, every word that you speak to people around you, every action that you do, you integrate all of that into your spiritual life and make your life a spiritual practice, integrated, whether it's with your family, your work colleagues, your spiritual colleagues. When you're sitting by yourself, you just make friends with yourself, yeah, which is an extraordinarily good ability to have, just to be friendly with ourselves. And as you do that, you are really boosting your spiritual practice. You are making your ordinary life more meaningful. And when you come down to sit on your cushion and do your meditation practice, your meditation is also going to be far more powerful as a result. So see if you can use that perception a little bit and see if you can kind of shift things a bit and see what happens. Does that answer? Do you want to add anything more, Martha?
It does. No, that's extremely helpful. Because I literally had been thinking about the exact opposite way around. But because I do, as everyone does, whilst meditating, have obsessive thoughts about what's happening next or what happened yesterday and what's going to happen when I get called or in early, etc. But and I had been thinking whilst meditating about the best way for me is just to practice. Letting it all go while meditating, but it's very informative to think about it. Just living the ordinary life in such a way that it doesn't then intrude on meditation through that one's able to find ease in that. So yeah. That makes a lot of sense to me.
Great. Excellent. Marvelous. Yeah. Okay. Does anyone else like to say anything? Yeah.
Actually, I would say.
Yeah.
Sorry, I'm in a little bit of darkness, but I was just wondering, you know how when you talk about kindness, like if you feel that your kindness is being taken for granted, you know, by family members, things like that, and I sort of don't know how to make the good karma, like from there, like if you become, like, sort of, if it has a reverse effect.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm just not sure, like, how to react after that.
Yeah. Yeah, that's it. No.
You hold on to your expectation that your kindness will be taken well.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Like you're doing it for yourself, not for a result from the other person.
Yeah. No, exactly. That's really a big part of the trick. You know, don't expect any gratitude on the part of others just because you are kind to them. I mean, so a lot of the time people will be grateful because a lot of the time they will feel that you are kind. A lot of the time they will react well. But sometimes it's not going to happen. And you're just going to have to know that this is just the nature of human beings. They are like this. It is not because they are, it's not really because they are ungrateful. It's just because they are conditioned in a way, or they got out of the bed on the wrong side, or they had an argument with somebody, or something went wrong, or they just are in the wrong mood, or they are distracted. There's a million reasons why people are not going to respond well to your kindness. Yeah, so don't worry so much about that. What you do know is that in general, people will respond well. Yeah, if you are an angry, nasty person, people are going to respond badly. Nobody likes angry people. Very unpleasant to be around. But so in general, people are going to respond well. But also make sure that you are, you know, you are kind, but you don't always have to be kind. Sometimes it's okay just to be quiet or just to go about your own business. You know, you don't have to kind of go out of your way to always say kind things or whatever. Sometimes you have to protect yourself a little bit, protect your mental state or whatever. You don't have to engage necessarily in the world either. So find that balance somewhere, yeah, and then you're kind of on the right track. And if you feel that people are really, sometimes people find that they are kind of kind maybe in the wrong way, so that people feel that they are needy perhaps in a certain way. And if there is a neediness in a person's kindness, then people will pick up on that and then they might actually take advantage of you. So in that case, it's better to withdraw a little bit, yeah, and to kind of just be by yourself. If people take advantage of you, withdraw. Don't kind of keep on doing things if you feel that they are doing the wrong thing or reacting in the wrong way.
Because I was just thinking, I think someone mentioned it a few weeks ago, but the Buddhist perspective on personal boundaries,
yeah,
and that type of thing, you know, so that kind of is built into that, the kindness thing, you know, I'm just not clear about that really.
Yeah, and you have to have personal boundaries, and you have to know when things aren't working out. You have to know, you have to know your own limits. Yeah, sometimes if you put yourself in a position where you get too much of the wrong kind of feedback, then there comes a point, becomes a breaking point in you as well. You only have so much kindness, you can only give so much, and there comes a point when you kind of can't give anymore. So you have to know your limits, and then you have to just withdraw a little bit. And this is part of what it means to come to the Armadale group. Armadale group is for withdrawal, yeah, to withdraw from the world and to kind of do things differently. Yeah. So when you so it's important to be able to withdraw sometimes. Ideally, the meditation is about finding a refuge inside, finding that peace inside of ourselves, where we withdraw from the world, and you find a sense of meaning, of happiness and joy even within, where you kind of let go of all those blooming problems in the world and just really, really enjoy here. If you can find that refuge within, it becomes very powerful and it becomes a very kind of safe place, a very simple safe place, just withdrawing within yourself. It's very beautiful to have that ability, because it means you cannot be touched by the world anymore, yeah? This is the power of it. Yeah.
Oh, thank you. That's a good answer.
Okay. Very good. Good luck.
Thank you.
Great. So let's just have a look. This is a question that came up on the screen here. So just, dear Ajahn Mali, so great to see you again. Okay, marvelous question. Why is it so easy to addict to the unwholesome, unhealthy habits like late night sleep, browsing the internet, and so hard to stick to wholesome habits like good time management, discipline, and regular meditation? Thank you. The reason is that we want to distract ourselves because we are not fully happy, we're not fully content, so we want to distract ourselves. Yeah, this is really the reason. And this is one of the reasons why it matters so much to enjoy the meditation. Because if you enjoy the meditation, that is when you will come back to it. That's when you get addicted to meditation, because you are enjoying it. And it's okay to be addicted. It's okay to be addicted to kindness. It's okay to be addicted to compassion. It's okay to be addicted to the peace of meditation, because these are positive things, yeah. And it leads in the right direction. If we don't have a little bit of addiction to kindness, well, we're not going to be kind. So it's okay. So that is the trick. So you have to learn to enjoy these other things, and then sometimes you have to. Also, you have to learn to make a barrier between yourself and the things that you don't want to do. Yeah. So if you find that you are spending too much time on the internet or whatever, then make it difficult for yourself to access that internet. Put your device or whatever is, lock it away and make it hard for you to access it after a certain time or something like that. Do something that makes it more difficult. And then by putting a little bit of a barrier between you and the thing you shouldn't be doing, that often helps you to stop you from doing things that you don't normally, probably isn't good for you in the long run. This is you're quite right. This is a very serious problem, this idea of being able to withdraw from the world. And in the long run, you know, it only the only way to do it really is to see that it is detrimental to you. It doesn't really work. And you know, one way that the Buddha teaches to overcome that addiction to things is to remember you're going to die here. Yeah, and you don't know when death is going to happen. And if death is going, if you're going to die in tonight, in 2 hours, are you going to spend the last 2 hours of your life surfing on some stupid website? No, right? There's no way you're going to go to those websites if you're going to die in 2 hours. But the problem is, it's always a bit like we're going to die in 2 hours because we never know when it's going to happen. Yeah. So the death contemplation, don't make it into something unpleasant. But if the death contemplation is used wisely, it reminds you of the value of your time. Yeah, time is so valuable. Now is the opportunity to do something right. Yeah, simple things like that can turn your mind in the right direction. And then hopefully can make you get your priorities right. It's really a matter of getting our priorities right. Then sometimes go on a retreat. Yeah, Jhana Grove is now gradually opening up again, our retreat center here. Come here, because then it's much more difficult to use your devices and things. And do things like that to kind of get you out of your ordinary habits, out of your ordinary, a little bit out of your comfort zone. Yeah, and then there's more likely you'll be able to focus in the right way. But it is difficult, especially today when the world is so utterly, when we're always kind of online. It's actually, I don't really know if the world we have now is all that wholesome, to be honest. Sometimes you wonder whether we're actually just on a kind of destructive path, to be honest, and whether we need to kind of correct our world a little bit. Anyway, I wish you good luck. There's no easy answers to these things, unfortunately. So you have to just try and test and try to find the right way here. Thank you, Ajahn. And AMG, I am off to work. Okay, off to work, Martha. See you later. Bye-bye. okay, good. So that is the questions we have. Does anyone have anything else they want to say? Everyone happy? Anyone unhappy?
Ajahn Brahmali, can I ask a really difficult question?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Relatively new to meditation.
Yeah.
So how do I know that I have sufficient mindfulness to watch my breath? So it's like every time I watch my breath, I feel like I'm controlling it. So
yeah.
How do I know I have the sufficient mindfulness to watch my breath?
Yeah. Yeah. That's a really, really important question. And it's a very, very difficult one to give an absolute answer to. You're really going to have to try a little bit. Yeah, you're going to have to test it out yourself a little bit to find out what the right time is. But in general, you can have some idea that you don't want to, the mind should really have settled down a lot. Yeah, there shouldn't be a lot of thinking in your mind. That's the first thing. It should be fairly settled down. That's the first point. Occasional thoughts, of course, you're going to have them. But it should be reasonably settled down. And there should also be a reasonable degree of clarity. Yeah, there shouldn't be like you are feeling really tired or really kind of, or very restless or anything like that. But you should feel not too much thinking and a certain degree of clarity. Now, to know exactly how much peace and how much clarity you require, you're going to have to test it out yourself. It's almost impossible to convey that. But over time, you will kind of find what is appropriate. Yeah. And in the meantime, while you're waiting for the clarity to arise, what you do is you use little techniques, the kind of things I was talking about today. Yeah, things that turn you away from the world, that makes you understand that the world is a problem. Actually forget about the blooming world and kind of enjoy the meditation instead. Come back to the spiritual path, which really is the only meaningful thing in life. And also the joyful side. Use little techniques just to kind of guide your mind in the right direction, so the mind kind of understands where it is supposed to find meaning and where it is supposed to find something positive. All of these things are you just have to develop them basically over time, and then gradually they come together. One of the things about life is that life is very up and down, and even more so as a layperson than as a monastic. As a monastic, life is more stable. So you can expect that days will vary enormously. Some days you may feel really inspired, you may feel really happy because something has gone well or whatever. Your meditation flows like, you know, whoa, this is it, I'm almost enlightened now. You know, there's no way, no turning back. And the next day is completely terrible. And you thought you had it all together, but actually you didn't at all. And you didn't realize how conditioned the mind was. So expect the mind to be very fluctuating like that. Don't expect to have a kind of steady thing. And try to learn from each experience. Yeah, every time you will, if you contemplate at the end of your meditation, and you look for the signs that the meditation is either improving or declining, and then you start to understand, look at the causes for why that is happening. That is how you learn about meditation practice. And you learn about it from your experience. And that is the best way to learn, because then you see it directly in your own mind. You see the causality. If I think like this, it leads to that. If I perceive like this, it leads to this thing. If I think like this, then I let go of certain things. Yeah, and in this way, you kind of understand the processes of the mind and how the mind works. Okay, good luck. Yeah. Okay, everyone. So time is going faster. Anything else anyone else would like to say? Or is everyone...
I only want to say, Ajahn Brahmani, thank you very much for your workshops you were doing. I was watching the last two, the dependent origination and the neighbor eightfold path.
Okay.
And I think after all, they're not that brilliant. It's very, very good information, because you get a little bit more in-depth information and knowledge about the things.
Yeah.
And thank you very much for doing that. And hopefully you are doing much more.
okay, marvelous. Yeah. Now, thank you for that feedback, Ulin. That's very kind of you to say that. One of the things that we try to do at the Buddhist Society, we try to do things in different ways, to teach the Dhamma in different ways. Because you learn different things depending on how you present this. And so I would say that if you want to give feedback to the Buddhist Society and you have some ideas of something that we could do differently, we're always open to feedback and always open to new ways of doing things. In fact, the reason why we're doing these workshops is in part because it was suggested by the lay people. Yeah, this is a part of the reason why we're doing this.
I have already
won this
workshop.
Okay. Good. Okay.
Mari, would that be great if we can have online retreat together with you?
Okay, Becky, nice to see you here. I have this, you should see my schedule is actually packed with all kinds of stuff, with online stuff actually for a long time. So so anyway, yeah. Okay, let me just talk a little bit towards the end here. We have another 15 minutes or so. I'll just bring up a few things that have been on my mind in over the last few weeks. Usually what I talk about is the things that are on my mind, because it's easy, it is already there, so it kind of it comes quite naturally. And one of the things that I often like to focus on the one hand, I love the basic teaching of the Buddha, the dependent origin. Yes,
you
sorry.
Unmute yourself, please?
Oh.
Sorry, that was my fault.
Okay. So did everything get lost, or did you hear anything?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. Sorry. I'm just going to talk a little bit about for the last 15 minutes or so. And I was just saying that usually when I talk, I tend to talk about things that are on my mind. Yeah. And because that is kind of easy to talk about. Although I do enjoy talking about the fundamentals of the Buddhist path, the Noble Eightfold Path, and dependent origination, the Four Noble Truths, and all of these things. And these things are tremendously important. And especially if you apply them to your own life in the right way, they are incredibly important and useful. But on the other hand, I also like to think about the Dhamma and how it connects with the events of the world around us. How should we view some of the events of the world from a Dhamma point of view? And I thought just very briefly to talk a little bit about the things that we've been seeing in Myanmar, in Burma, recently. Because it's very strange with Myanmar, because on the one hand, it is one of the most staunchly Buddhist countries in the world. If you go there, there's Buddhist monasteries everywhere. There's a stupa on every hill in Myanmar. There's very famous cities where it's kind of covered with stupas everywhere. And it's kind of this awesome sight when you see these things. So on the one hand, you have this very Buddhist country. On the other hand, you have all of these things that seem to be very un-Buddhist. The military killing people in the streets and all of these terrible things happening there. There is this really big contrast in Burmese society. So one of the things that is interesting is how should a monastic, how should we as monastics actually respond to things that happen in Myanmar? How involved should we be, if you like, in politics? In generally speaking, monks should not be involved in politics, but still, it feels like you should be doing something when the situation is going wrong. So what is acceptable? And one of the things that monastics have done in Myanmar, and they have done also elsewhere, when things really get out of hand, and that is a special, a special procedure called the procedure of turning the bowl upside down. The upside down bowl procedure. And what the upside down bowl procedure means is that the Sangha, the monastic Sangha, they come together and they say, this is something going really wrong in our society. These people are doing the wrong thing and they are hurting the Buddhist community or whatever. So we're not going to receive alms. We're not going to take any food from these people. So then, if you decide, for example, this happened in Myanmar, it happens with the military, when the military personnel come, you turn the bowl upside down. And it doesn't sound like much. It doesn't sound like, why would people even be bothered? But actually, in a Buddhist society, it's a very powerful symbolic thing. If you kind of stand there, you're going to put alms food in the monk's bowl, and he shows you the bottom of the bowl. It is actually very, very a powerful symbol of what is going on. And people feel incredibly hurt when that happens. And you may have some idea, I don't know, many of you will have come to Bodhidharma Monastery before. And imagine it when the monk comes to you, they cannot turn away, turn the ball upside down. They don't want to have anything to do with you. It is like you're being rejected. And because you're being rejected by a Buddhist monk, who symbolizes Buddhism in a very big way, symbolizes the Dhamma, symbolizes all the things that we're trying to do on this path, it is a powerful statement, almost as if you are being rejected from Buddhism altogether. And for this reason, it is very powerful. And for this reason, the Sangha has the opportunity to influence in places like Myanmar, if we do it in a wise way. And if we do it because it is hurting Buddhism, not because we don't like the military, but because it is hurting Buddhism. And because Buddhist people, for example, are being killed by the military. What this does, it shows you something about the power of generosity in Buddhism. How important it actually is. Here, the monks are walking in the streets, receiving alms food, and people give alms to the monks. And it is like it is a privilege to be able to give alms to the monks. This is how powerful this is, and this is why this really works. It is almost as if this actually makes you into a Buddhist. This is what creates the good qualities inside of you by sharing, by being part of this Buddhist community in a positive way. That is how powerful it is. And then if you refuse that, it is almost as if you are refusing one of the fundamental things that makes the Buddhist path work. So as a monastic, usually it is our duty to receive things from people. If people want to offer me something, very, very, almost always I will say yes, unless it is something really inappropriate, yeah, like whatever. But usually you always say yes. Wow, that's very, because it is such a beautiful thing to be able to give something to somebody else. And if I want to give something to someone else, I tend to be very happy when someone receives it, yeah? Especially, of course, if they can use it. But if someone is happy to take my gift, I always feel, wow, well, that's very, that is so, that kind of makes that gift real in a sense. It transforms the gift into an act of kindness that has mental content and significance afterwards. And please, I would ask each one of you, never be afraid of receiving. Sometimes in this world, I have noticed how people are very good at giving to others, supporting others. But if someone is to support that person, sometimes they say no. It's almost as if there is an ego there that says, I am a giver, not a receiver. But never think like that, because it is only by receiving that we allow other people in the world to do acts of kindness. So sometimes please be a receiver. Please allow yourself to be cared for if you need to be cared for. Never feel embarrassed about being sick or whatever. And make sure that you allow other people to help you in whatever way. Because when we give and we receive in this way, that is when we are building up together the qualities of being true Buddhist and building up the qualities that allow us to move forward on the Buddhist path. It's such an important thing. And we should never be too proud to receive. If we are too proud to receive, there is an imbalance inside of us. We need to balance that relationship out, and then we are on the right track. So this is the first thing that occurs to me when I see what is happening in Myanmar, and one of the things that we should do as monastics, in my opinion. The other thing that we should do, and we should always condemn violence. Yeah, we should never be afraid to say that violence is wrong, because this is such a foundational aspect of the Buddhist path, to be kind and to be caring to other people. We should not say that the military is bad because they're violent. There's no need to mention any names, but we can just say in general that violence is wrong, and everybody will understand what is happening here. It was fascinating because I was also in Hong Kong. Yeah, and Becky, you will remember that I was in Hong Kong. And when I was in Hong Kong, this is about a couple of years ago now, or maybe just over a year ago anyway. And when I was there, that was just the time when there was a lot of trouble in Hong Kong and people were protesting in the streets and all of that stuff. And then people wanted me to take sides. People asked me, what side are you on? Are you on the side of the Chinese government, or are you on the side of the people of Hong Kong? What side are you on? And I knew straight away that this is a trap. Yeah, you cannot, as a monastic, you should never take sides in a political situation like that. But what you can say, and not only what you can say, but what you have a duty to say as a monastic, is that violence is wrong. And as long as you say that violence is wrong, then whoever perpetrates that violence, whether the violence is coming from the government or the violence is coming from the protesters, that is where the problem is. And then people will have to decide for themselves who is acting wrongly in that situation. And in fact, this principle of non-violence, it was interesting. I came across a scholarly paper that was written about non-violent movements around the world. And according to this scholarly paper, it was basically saying that if you want to have a protest against something, yeah, like here in Australia or whatever it is, then non-violence is always the right way to go. When you are not violent if you want to protest against something, then you get people on your side and people will support you. And through history, apparently, it is the non-violent movements. Think about India and Mahatma Gandhi, for example. It is the non-violent movements that have been successful. So as a monastic, I always feel very strongly, yeah, when these situations come up, speak the Dhamma, what the Dhamma is, and then people will have to make whatever they want out of that. But that is an obligation as a monastic, and you should never really be afraid of speaking the Dhamma. Once you don't speak the Dhamma, then you can become a tool for oppression in whatever society that you're in. So this is the second thing that I think of in Myanmar and Burma, and how to resolve things. And I think it's very important that the monastics speak out in this particular way here. But the third thing, which also is very interesting from a Buddhist point of view, and that is the whole idea of how we should govern our society. Yeah, what is the ideal way of governing from a Buddhist point of view? And it is fascinating when you read the suttas and you read how the Sangha, for example, is constituted and how the Sangha works. And the Sangha, of course, works in a democratic way. Yeah, it's this marvelous institution of the Sangha which works in a democratic way. And obviously, the Buddha laid down the democratic ideal of the Sangha, because that is how he saw the ideal way of governing things. Once you have hierarchies, and of course hierarchies exist everywhere, it even exists within the Buddhist Sangha in the present day. If you travel to most Buddhist countries, you tend to see hierarchies everywhere. But hierarchies tend to corrupt people. Hierarchies tend to accumulate power, yeah, in people. And once you have power, you also have access to things in the world. You have access to, you can control things and you can do things with the world. And that is why people want power. So hierarchies tend to be corrupting. Yeah? And you can see that within the Sangha in the present day, because the Sangha also is hierarchical. So the ideal Sangha is a flat one, where all the monks are on an equal level. There is no hierarchy, and because there is no hierarchy, there is also a much less chance of things getting corrupted and getting out of hand. By extension, of course, the Buddha would also then, it seems reasonable to think that this is also an ideal way of also running a society in general, because this is the principle used by the Sangha itself. So to what extent we should talk about that as Buddhist monastics, it really depends on time and place. But it is fascinating that these principles are there, and that they tend, from a Buddhist point of view, to lead to more peace, more harmony, less oppression in society, and a more sense of collaboration, of working together, rather than having unhealthy structures in the world that we live in. So this is what I have been thinking about in recent days. I don't know if it is of interest to anyone, but anyway, I'm just talking about these because I think it is quite nice. So that is all I have for now.